This episode is brought to you by GetMobile ID, the smart choice for MDL implementations. Put citizens in control with GetMobile ID. Fully ISO compliant and UL certified for all transaction modes. Learn more at getgroupna.com. Welcome to AmbaCast, bringing news, information, and expertise to the Amba community. Here's your host, Ian Grossman. Enjoy the show.
Welcome back, everyone. This week, I'm here with two members of our AMVA team to talk about one of our new products available to our members, which is the updated version of the Ignition Interlock Best Practice. And joining me today are Brian Arsino and Jesse Ross from the AMVA team. They're the ones that managed and supported this working group. Brian, Jesse, both of you have been here before, so welcome back to the AmvaCast.
Thank you, Ian.
Though we were saying before we press record, you've all heard Brian's voice many times over the many episodes that he's been a part of. This is Jesse's second appearance, and our first one was so long ago, it was early on when we started this. You've never done it in person before.
Never in person. Excited to be here.
Yeah, so we're glad to have you back. So the new best practice is available. It is on our website, yes?
Yes.
And this is now the third edition? Fourth edition.
I've lost track.
Third edition. And it's interesting that something that has become so recognizable as Ignition Interlock, we still discover new and better ways to do it. And our members said we need some updates, some expansion, some new content. But I think it's important to frame it in why the Ignition Interlock conversation is still so critical, in that the amount of lives we're still losing every year to impaired driving. It is still the number one cause of deaths on our roadways, almost 14,000 deaths a year just due to alcohol impairment. The silver lining of that cloud is nearly all states now in the U.S. and most provinces in Canada have some form of ignition interlock law.
48 of the 50.
48 of the 50. Do we know the metric on the Canadian side?
No, but I can say that the majority of provinces do have an ignition interlock law of some sort.
And across the board, when jurisdictions have these laws, they normally look to either their DMV or provincial state police agency to administer the program. There are exceptions to that, but the vast majority of public agencies who have to administer ignition interlock programs are AMVA members.
That's right.
Yeah. So let's talk about what's new and different in this edition of the Ignition Interlock Best Practice. I've done some review, and there's some chapters I want to call out and talk specifically about, and we could talk maybe then holistically for those who are maybe new to it. Actually, let me start there. We've got enough people that are sometimes new. They hear the phrase ignition interlock, but I think sometimes there's some misconceptions to what an ignition interlock is or isn't. So, Brian, give me the 101. For someone who doesn't know this space, maybe their only familiarity of it is having watched the movie 40-year-old version where, you know, there's that scene where Steve Carell hands it to Leslie Mann to blow into it. What's an ignition interlock?
So an ignition interlock is a hardwired device in the vehicle that before the ignition will work, the person has to provide a breath sample into the device. And if the person's blood alcohol content is below a certain set point, which in most cases is 0.025, the vehicle will start. If they're at or above that threshold, the vehicle will not start. Now, the key difference is in every state except for Utah, the legal limit is 0.08. In Utah, it's 0.05, another conversation. But when you've been convicted of DUI and you're ordered to have an ignition interlock device, the threshold is always set even much lower than the legal limit. And again, in most cases, and matter of fact, our document recommends that threshold set point be 0.025.
And that's based on a fundamental philosophy that if you have been convicted of this crime, the tolerance for any alcohol in the system should be much lower.
That's correct.
Yeah. So that's what the device does. Different jurisdictions have a different level of requirement of when it might be installed as well, right? Sometimes it's because you were caught impaired driving. sometimes it's because you were caught impaired and your alcohol content was at a certain level to begin with. What are the different, Jesse, what are the different colors of that variety that might determine when or why a jurisdiction would require you to have an interlock?
So you're exactly right, Ian. It is, you know, it can be based on occurrence, breath alcohol level, whether it's a mandatory or a voluntary program where you actually have to apply and be approved for the ignition interlock device. And then that the duration of the requirement is dependent of all those factors as well. And within those factors, then you have certain requirements that are imposed on drivers based on cameras. Do you compliance-based removal? There's several factors that are built into that actual requirement. That does vary by state.
And the requirement to have it or not to have it, if I remember correctly, we actually don't have a recommendation, but our best practice focuses more on once a jurisdiction decides that you should have an ignition lock or have to have it, this is the best way to administer the program.
Right, right.
Correct. And I will say, too, so that... and. The way that we get to the ignition interlock requirement can vary based on court conviction or administrative equivalent. And so it's, or a hybrid mixture of both. And so it is important, you know, there's many ways to get there, but our stance, as long as you get there, when you get there, here's what you do in order to maintain the compliance.
So if I can add to that, that actually dovetails right into one of our specific recommendations. Mm-hmm. I mentioned earlier that 48 of 50 states have some kind of ignition interlock law. Mm-hmm. I can say that 30 of the states have what we call an all offender law, which means it's not based on just high BAC. That means, it is not based on multiple convictions. It means first time convicted at 0.08 or higher, you're required to have an ignition interlock. That's what we refer to in all offender law. And 30 of the 50 states have that.
And that's the gold star, if you will. That is where, you know, when you look at your program and you want to gauge and benchmark where you'd like to go, that is the gold star of ignition interlock programs, is the all offender.
And so does that start to tie into one of the new chapters is around regulatory standards? And it sounds like that's some of what you're talking about here are these standards around regulations. What more does the new chapter get into there with regulatory standards?
So in our previous versions, we have model legislation, which sets the framework for what you need to have an ignition interlock program in your jurisdiction. The model regulations takes it a step further. We say, okay, you have the model legislation. How do you accomplish that? What are the metrics? And this is everything from vendor compliance to customer compliance. You know, how often does the customer go in? When they go in, what can they expect? Is it a brick and mortar building? Do they have, you know, we're very, you know, we get into those details because those are the requirements that the jurisdictions, DMVs, will be tasked with enforcing. So we take it a step further and to help really flush out those detailed program requirements in the model regulations.
So what are some of those requirements? When we suggest that someone should have it and they need to come in for a compliance check, how often do we recommend that drivers with an interlock come in for that?
So that really is based on technology. Back in the day, it was every 30 days and you physically had to go in to a brick and mortar building to have your device calibrated. And now with technology, which is obviously vendor driven, there's opportunities for mail-in or, you know, the duration in which you need to go in for calibration is longer.
And so technology's better.
Technology's better. Mm-hmm. So it really just depends on the state and what, you know, we kind of leave that open just for technology to lead the way, which is why we've had vendors, you know, are part of their technical advisors to the working group as well.
And there's that. Has that marketplace expanded as we've seen more of these jurisdictions requiring them? Have we seen the marketplace expand? Or I remember early on, a decade or so ago, there was some challenge because there was only so many products and so many vendors in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. Have we seen that shift?
So, yes. There has been, I mean, there's many vendors. And so with that, you know, the model regulations are ever so important because, you know, you have what, you know, what the tools you need to approve a vendor. What are those metrics? And is it an MOU? Do you have agreements set in place? If you have agreements, what are those agreements? How often should vendors report to you on their statistics and their funding mechanisms, if applicable in your jurisdiction? And so, yes, there's, you know, plenty
so
of vendors out there.
That lift for the agency that's administering the program, we focus a lot on the oversight of the driver who's using the mechanism and their driving impacts and licensing restrictions, I'd imagine the oversight of these technology companies that are actually being the providers, it's got to be a big administrative part of being the agency that oversees this program.
You're correct. And in most cases, that's an inherited procedure or oversight. And so that kind of leads into another new chapter of ours for the program oversight chapter 6, because we do recognize that, you know, that is a heavy lift for jurisdictions. And, you know, you have this program. DUIs are not new. Ignition Interlock isn't new. But now there's all this oversight to it. And so we really wanted to kind of focus in on that as well in this new version to provide guidance for jurisdictions and resources available to help kind of ease the, you know, the workload.
And what were the challenges you were hearing from members in that space that fueled this discussion around needing new guidance and best practices?
Staffing. A big thing. Staffing and the manpower to dedicate the resources and the time needed for this program. And Washington is a great model. They were one of the first that, and I'm not saying that just because Brian's here, but you know, they were one of the first and they set the bar high for how a program should look and function with dedicated law enforcement officers on staff that, you know, are trained specific to ignition interlock offenders and what to look for and how to enforce those requirements. And so, you know, the rest of us, how do we get to the Washington model? And so that's really, you know, knowing that like staffing is the big thing, because we all would love to have a program where we could do all of these things, but in reality, resources, you know, is a... always yeah, there, absolutely. Always short. So,
and it reminds me of some years ago, we put out the best practice on third-party agent administration, and there was a lot of focus on, do you have the right MOU or contract set up? How do you audit their performance? Imagine some of that are similar principles here in managing that technology contract.
Sure, absolutely.
All right, so anything else in that new chapter that you really wanted to highlight in terms of the new chapter? It's funny, the new chapter is entitled Ignition Interlock Device Program Administration, mm-hmm. which almost is kind of the whole point of the whole best practice, right? Absolutely. It's the administration of the Ignition Interlock yes. program. So how does that chapter really differentiate itself from the common theme of a best practice around administering the best practice?
Yeah, so, you know, when we think Ignition Interlock, we obviously, you know, we think the device, the actual requirement. And then, you know, as we are talking about now, there's so many moving pieces to it and things that, you know, essentially to keep the boat afloat that need to be in place. And one of the things that I'm most excited about in chapter 6 is the contact center. Because, you know, we've also talked about vendor sort of, you know, keeping the vendor in compliance and the device itself, but, you know, the phone calls, the customers, the assistance needed and what a contact center might look like to provide that type of support for that customer base. That's really something that, you know, is definitely necessary and critical to the success of an ignition interlock program.
So, you know, we mentioned earlier on that there are some jurisdictions where the law enforcement agency is the program administrator of the program. And so that's different jurisdiction to jurisdiction. But Brian, across the board, whether the law enforcement agency is administering the program or not, they're still dealing with the impacts of the driver having the device in the vehicle, needing to know how to interact with that driver, understanding that license restriction. So one of the new and expanded areas I think we focused on this time around is better preparing law enforcement officers, whether it's at roadside or other interactions with drivers, to understand what this device means, what that license restriction means, and how to handle it.
That's right. What we learned is that, you know, every state police academy has impaired driving curriculum and things of that nature, but a lot of them do not include anything specific to ignition interlocks. Mm-hmm. So actually, prior to this effort, with one of the previous editions, we actually created a training video for law enforcement mm-hmm. on what to do and expect when you encounter an ignition interlock device at roadside during a traffic stop. But we decided in this third edition of the document to actually create a new chapter, Chapter 8, Basics for Law Enforcement Roadside Ignition Interlock Interaction, to provide that written guidance for our law enforcement members. The purpose of the chapter is to help law enforcement officers to understand the basic requirements of the IID restriction and the steps necessary to investigate whether an IID has been circumvented or not mm. when they have that roadside encounter. A lot of times you stop a vehicle for anything, speeding or any kind of violation. You notice that there's an ignition interlock device. So what are those steps to follow to determine whether it's been circumvented? And again, like you mentioned, if the driver presents a license with an ignition interlock restriction, how does the officer determine whether they're in compliance with that restriction or not? Mm-hmm. And if they're not in compliance, what do you do about it?
Right.
So those are all the things that we created in our new Chapter 8, the basics for interaction for law enforcement. We're very excited to have that. In addition, the working group viewed the previous training video to see if it needed to be redone. And they said, you know, this video, even though it's 3 years old, is mm-hmm. still spot on. We did a little bit of tweaking to the introduction, but essentially we republished the video as new to push it out again. And again, one of our best practice recommendations in the document is for all our state police law enforcement agencies to indoctrinate our 6 easy roadside steps into their basic DUI enforcement curriculum.
Mm. What are those 6 steps?
Okay, well, I can get into that. First of all is to determine whether the driver is restricted to operate a vehicle equipped with an IED. Just because the vehicle may be equipped with an IED doesn't mean the person that's driving it at the time has that restriction.
Oh, okay.
So that's the very first step. Secondly, determine that the vehicle being operated has an IED and that the required components are present. In other words, is that ignition like required to have a camera? If that requirement is there, is the camera present? So a checklist of equipment requirements, mm-hmm. are they all present? The third step is to have the driver turn the vehicle off and observe the handset display to see a status change, because the device might be present. That doesn't tell us that it's connected properly. So you can only really determine that by turning the vehicle off and having them attempt to restart it to see it basically shut down and relight up and show a status. So that's the only way to see this actually correctly connected, not just there, right? Fourth is to wait for the IED to fully power down and power up, which could be a 3-minute process. The fifth step is to have the driver attempt to restart the vehicle by providing that breath samples. If they were just getting in it, right, making sure that it's at or below that set threshold. And again, I'll say 0.025, which is our recommended set level. And if it doesn't start, then the officer has probable cause to investigate that driver for a potential DUI. Maybe they have more than that level in their system. We need to investigate that. Whether or not they had reason to believe impairment before the stop, like lane travel or other indicators. Right. And then finally, after they give the breath sample, it gives them steps on whether or not they should or how to investigate further for possible DUI.
So it seems, though, I mean, on one hand, that sounds like a quick, easy 6-point checklist, but there's a lot in those, especially those earlier points, really trying to train and expect these law enforcement officers to understand this technology, how it works, how it operates, what to look for. It's not until you get to step 6 that it kind of feeds back into what they might already traditionally be trained for, which is, I think this person might be impaired. What do I do there? How much of a lift is that going to be for enforcement agencies away from maybe what a trooper was traditionally trained to be able to do roadside, to now know, particularly on the technology piece, how does this device work? How do I check if this device works? Are the components of this device there? And then back to what Jesse said earlier, there's these variations between vendors.
Right. Okay. 2-part answer. So first of all, every state police academy has some form of impaired driving training in their curriculum already. So it's not a brand new thing. It's infusing ignition interlock knowledge specifics into that already existing curriculum. So in those terms, it's not a heavy lift. I also don't want to scare our listening audience away. They don't need to be technical experts on the device, the inner workings, the science. They don't have to be experts at that level. They have to have basic awareness, basic knowledge, and the importance of that point is, when I talk about infusing this training into basic impaired driving curriculum, in my view, you could accomplish all this inside of 30 minutes. So you may have an impaired driving curriculum that's anywhere, depending on the state, from 4 to 8 hours. We're talking about adding about half an hour, okay, to specifically give them the knowledge they need to efficiently detect and act appropriately when they encounter this at roadside.
Interesting. And Jesse, this actually might be a better question back to you. The very first point that Brian made was understanding the licensing restrictions. I know that's one of your areas of expertise. Mm-hmm. You know, how will the officer know that restriction is there or not?
So the hope is, and if you're listening out there, implement the T restriction in your state. It's the T restriction. And so that's an indicator that is present on the front of the license. Front is the recommendation, but some also will display it on the back as well with a descriptor. So that is the way to easily identify at face value that this person has an ignition interlock requirement. The hope is that I'm pulled over, I'm going to hand you my credential. It has the T restriction. Some states even have went above that and will have their fancy with a padlock or some sort of other indicator. It will actually say ignition interlock on the front of the credential. And so that is the hope that at face value, you know, you see that credential, they have it on them, they present it to you as a part of that initial first step.
And if they've received the restriction, they've been mandated to get it. Mm-hmm. And yet they've not received or have decided not to use their new physical credential. When that officer takes any credential and then runs it through their system, they go back to their car and they run it, they would receive that information electronically, even if it's not physically on the card.
Yes, and that is what we're working towards. In state, in jurisdiction, if you're traveling within your state of residence, yes, absolutely, it's going to show. The reciprocity continues to be the number one challenge in our community, and something that we are hopefully we do have a solution for in this latest version to help combat that and to help ensure uniformity among jurisdictions. Because right now, the ignition interlock program, although most of us have it, it's very different in nature. And what we've tried to say, or what we're our hope is that even though you might have, you know, your requirements might be X, Y, and Z and A, B, and C somewhere else, that you can agree on these certain factors for reciprocity purposes.
And isn't that reciprocity piece, I don't want to confuse our listeners too much, that reciprocity piece has more to do with if somebody is moving their license from one jurisdiction to another jurisdiction, whether that restriction will stay with them, versus if I'm a driver from Maryland and I have that restriction, even if I'm driving out here in Oklahoma where we're recording from today, if an Oklahoma trooper was to run my Maryland license, they would see that restriction is attached to my license if I had it.
Correct.
Yeah. So the reciprocity piece is really focused more on if I'm moving my where I'm getting my license from. Mm-hmm. If I have the restriction in one place, will it stay with me to the other place? And so allowing people not to maybe game the system of, all right, well, I received the restriction in one state, but I know next door it's a higher threshold, so let me move over there and they won't give me the restriction.
Absolutely. And our hope is that even with, you know, when we talk about reciprocity moving from one state to another, that even, you know, with some of the codes that we're proposing, the ACD codes, if you're familiar with those, our hope is that, you know, those can be universally used even within in your jurisdiction so that those will also be universally recognized.
Yeah. Brian, well, we talked a lot about training state troopers, which obviously, because it's a core of our law enforcement membership, there are non-jurisdiction law enforcement who have to interact with drivers at roadside around ignition interlock and impaired driving, whether it's a metropolitan city, municipality, police department, or a county sheriff's type patrol. Have we been able to have any conversations with those audiences? Because it's, I mean, in many ways it would be the same training, the same protocols, they have the access to the same data. So how do we spread that to multiply the workforce, if you will, to bat impaired driving?
Right, that's a great question. And really AMVA does not undertake that effort directly. What happens at the state level, since the state police and highway patrol agencies are our members, and we push this out to them, in most cases, municipal and county sheriff police agencies turn to their state police partners and ask them for copies of their curriculum. How do you train this? How do you do this? And so the state police, for example, I'll go to my state in Washington, will share their curriculum with our Criminal Justice Training Commission, which trains all other law enforcement in the state that aren't state troopers. They oftentimes get our curriculum from us and use it as a model. And that's how we're relying on that process to get this pushed out to all law enforcement.
Mm-hmm. And if I could also add, so we do also mention outreach and partnerships in the best practices guide as well, where we, you know, that tends to fall on the DMVs to initiate that, you know, communication and to build that bridge. And so we speak to that and we recognize it and acknowledge it. And we provide tips for DMVs to engage different partners at the court level, law enforcement and what have you.
So at the court level, you know, one thing that strikes me in this ecosystem of impaired driving, we've just spent over the last year a huge push on our fraud activities to have stronger partnerships with prosecutors' offices that, you know, Brian and his colleagues have been on talking about fighting fraud and being able to make sure that when our investigators find good cases, prosecutors are willing to go through with them and take these people to court. We find a similar challenge on the impaired driving side sometimes where there's a community of prosecutors who may not be as aggressive as we in the safety community would want them to be on these impaired driving cases. How do we get into that in any of this, the stakeholder piece of the Ignition Interlock?
Yeah, we do. And one of the great resources that has gotten stronger and stronger in recent years are what are called traffic safety resource prosecutors, or TSRPs. Every state has at least one. Most states have multiple TSRPs, and they specialize in criminal traffic driving offenses. So they specialize in prosecuting DUI cases, especially the complex ones. Because let's face it, the DUI defense attorney community is very robust, mm-hmm. and they're very experienced. Yeah. And in most cases, they're very good. Yeah. On the prosecutor side, it's usually the junior rookie prosecutors that get these cases, and they're not up to that task always. And so we lean on our traffic safety resource prosecutors in the community to be the subject matter experts to teach and coach and assist all the other prosecutors to be successful.
Absolutely.
And what about the, you know, and then the court side as well, the judges that are having to adjudicate this? I know we've done a lot more outreach lately with the judicial partners. I assume this is, you know, one of those many conversations we're having with them.
Yeah, so it is definitely at every opportunity being discussed. And that is something we also mentioned within the partnerships and outreach section is exactly that, meeting with your judicial partners, explaining the program. And that can be even, you know, going to, you know, your court conferences and having devices on display for, you know, the court clerks. And when we get to that level, it's really, you know, a reporting issue, a topic as well. You know, how do I record this? What do I convict under? Is it tampering? Is it circumventing? Are they actually violating? And a lot of times, you know, the courts will call the DMVs, the court clerk and say, hey, you know, I just want to make sure that we're, you know, on this track and this is what we're looking to convict under. And so, you know, that the DMV has really become the resource for that. And it is something that is continuing to grow and we hope to expand on as we move forward.
Anything else in this latest update of the best practice we haven't talked about that either one of you want to make sure our members were particularly aware of?
Yeah. I do. I have one. Sure. And, you know, there's so many recommendations in this document, we can't possibly cover them in a 30-minute AmbiCast, but there is one I want to give special Please. Attention to. Mentioned earlier that 48 of 50 states have some sort of law. 30 of those 50 have compliance-based removal. That is a best practice recommendation.
The compliance-based removal.
And I want to describe very quickly why that's so important. A lot of states that don't have compliance-based removal, it's time-based. In other words, you're required to have this ignition interlock for 6 months. But the customer can have failure after failure after failure. All they have to do is they're 6 months and they can have it taken off. But
just
their
do
behavior,
your time and you're good.
Their behavior hasn't changed. Compliance-based removal may still be the same 6 months requirement, but 4 weeks in, you have a failure, your 6 month clock starts over. So you have to have 6 consecutive months of compliance before that ignition interlock can come off. And then we believe that that is what lends itself more towards actual behavior change. And so that is one best practice recommendation I wanted to call out. Jesse earlier mentioned our model legislation is an appendix to this document. And in that model legislation, we call that out specifically.
Okay. Very good. Absolutely. So the only topic that I, you know, is still reciprocity, I'd like to, you know, kind of discuss at a high level what it is that we're proposing. Yep. And reciprocity in the terms of I have an ignition interlock requirement, I'm now moving to a new jurisdiction, what happens to that requirement? And so, you know, one of the things in working, you know, we're at our third version now, so I'd say we're becoming quite the experts on this. You know, it varies, the restriction requirement. And some jurisdictions, they record it as an actual withdrawal, others an indicator on the credential in the same capacity as corrective lenses. You know, know, and we see they're very, jurisdictions are creative in how we enforce that and allow for that exchange. You know, we're seeing that neighboring jurisdictions partner with each other to accomplish mini reciprocity, if you will. And so that's really, you know, a main focus of this new version is reciprocity and how we can help. And so a few of the things that we actually have two proposals. The first one is that we create a new ACD code to actually record the restriction of ignition interlock. In today's world, that does not exist. There's a code for the violator. So in Brian's earlier example, I'm pulled over. Maybe I should have the device. It's not installed, or I'm tampering with it. We have a code for that, for the violator. But the actual initial requirement, there is no ACD uniform code for that requirement. So we're actually proposing that. And then in addition to that, we're hoping to take it a step further and actually have our systems to reflect said codes. And what I mean by that is, in today's world, you either have a not, you're either eligible for a license or you're not. So the world of restriction is the gray area, because you do have a form of driving privilege, provided that you're in compliance with whatever the requirement is. And so how is that translated in our systems? And in today's world, that is a hard stop. You are not eligible for a license. And so we're, you know, exploring the best way to reflect that in our systems. We have amazing systems, SIDLIS, PDPS, state to state, DHR, being the most recent, in ways that we can account for that in our systems and reflect that status, or, you know, that eligibility, if you will. So that is also reflected in the latest version.
Wonderful. So folks may want to learn more. They may want to go deeper. In addition to downloading the best practice on the website, I believe a number of the upcoming spring conferences have some sessions on ignition interlocks.
We do. And don't forget about the video. It's also available on the website.
Good. Well, Brian, Jesse, thank you for joining me to talk about it. Thank you for the work that you and the whole working group did to do this exciting update. You know, it's overall, it's another great example of sometimes when you get into the detail of what seems like administrative trivia of managing a relationship with a vendor, having the MOU, having to go through regulations. But really fundamentally, when we're talking about stopping impaired driving, this is literally life-saving work that our members are doing every day. So thanks for chatting about it. Thank you all for listening this week. As always, thanks to our producers, Claire Jeffrey and Chelsea Hadwin. Till next week, stay well.
Thank you for joining us for AmbaCast. Hosted by Ian Grossman, produced by Claire Jeffrey and Chelsea Hadwin, music by Gibson Arthur. This episode was brought to you by Get Mobile ID by Get Group North America. Visit us at amvacast.podbean.com and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, and Spotify.